This week on Making Contact.
This military escalation against Iraq will build instability. It will build chaos. It may erupt into a civil war. And it will, for a fact, increase anti-American sentiment.
The Iraqi people are going to defend their own sovereignty. Everybody who's endangered by this invasion is going to fight.
President Bush has often repeated that the Iraqi regime poses a grave and growing danger to the United States. But many people question that assessment. There's little doubt that Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein is a repressive leader who's used chemical weapons in the past. But is the United States justified in going to war against Iraq? On this edition of Making Contact, we take a look at that question. I'm Philip Babbitt, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. We're told by U.S. officials that Saddam Hussein is ready, willing, and able to launch weapons of mass destruction against the United States. The historic pallor of the events of September 11, 2001 tends to color support for preemptive strikes against Iraq with American piety and dissent with patriotic scorn. Still, opposition to war against Iraq is widespread.
I'm convinced that it will inspire hatred and fear and increase instability and insecurity.
Congresswoman Barbara Lee, a Democrat from California, speaking on the House floor October 8, 2002.
There have been those who have questioned the patriotism of opposition and have claimed that those calling for war have a monopoly on this virtue. Yet I believe, like many, that it is our patriotic duty to seek each and every non-military solution to eliminating the weapons of mass destruction. Containment, deterrence, and disarmament should be our goal. That has been and continues to be the American way.
Such words may ring hollow for some when we consider President Bush's October 7th assessment of the Iraqi regime's capabilities to use and produce weapons of mass destruction.
We know that the regime has produced thousands of tons of chemical agents, including mustard gas, sarin nerve gas, VX nerve gas. Saddam Hussein also has experience in using chemical weapons. He's ordered chemical attacks on Iran and on more than 40 villages in his own country.
Bush is correct in saying that Iraq has used chemical weapons against Kurds and against Iranian soldiers. I just wish that he and his supporters would complete the sentence.
Chris Tensing is editor of Middle East Report, a publication of the Middle East Research and Information Project. He says it's crucial to understand the history of U.S. support for Iraq's weapons programs.
Iraq used those weapons with the tacit support of the United States in the 1980s, when the United States was tilting towards Iraq in its war with Iran. And U.S. allies in the region, chiefly Saudi Arabia, bankrolled the Iraqi war effort at that time. Today, the power equation is completely reversed. Bush deploys that point as a way of establishing that Iraq poses a threat of using chemical weapons because it has done so in the past. But Iraq used them in the past when it knew that the international community, chiefly the United States, was looking the other way.
And with satellite photographs, the United States was helping Iraq take a good look at bombing targets in Iran. In August 1986, according to the Washington Post, the Central Intelligence Agency established a direct top-secret communications link between Washington and Baghdad. This enabled Iraq to bomb oil infrastructure with the intent of destroying Iran's economy, according to the Post. Iraq also used U.S. intelligence for mustard gas attacks on Iranian troops. This was happening while the Reagan administration was illegally shipping arms to Iran, part of the covert deal that would later become known as the Iran-Contra scandal. Assad Abulkhalil is a professor of political science at California State University Stanislaus and author of Bin Laden, Islam, and America's New War on Terrorism. He notes that a familiar figure in today's push for war against Iraq was formerly Reagan's Middle East envoy, who personally extended an invitation to Saddam Hussein to resume diplomatic relations, which had been severed since the 1967 Arab-Israeli War.
They sent a very famous Republican foreign policy strategist, his name may be familiar to the audience, Donald Rumsfeld, and who went there to Iraq, met with Saddam, and they basically were asking, what do you want us to give you, and please give us a shopping list, and he did, and then they provided them with all this weapons, intelligence, satellite pictures, and apparently germ warfare capabilities.
In subsequent meetings with the Hussein regime, Donald Rumsfeld, who is now U.S. Secretary of Defense, was fully aware of Iraq's use of chemical weapons. Yet U.S. military and diplomatic aid continued, says Rania Masri, director of the Southern Peace Research and Education Center and contributor to the book Iraq Under Siege.
Iraq did use chemical weapons against the Iranians in the Iraq-Iran war, and they did so not only with the economic and military backing of the United States, but also after they did so, we had Senator Bob Dole himself go to Baghdad and sit down with Saddam Hussein and reassure him that there will be no negative repercussions against him because of the use of chemical weapons. And there were none. Economic aid to Iraq continued and military aid to Iraq continued after that.
Other administrators in the U.S. government were not so supportive of a pro-Iraq strategy. According to an investigative series by the Los Angeles Times, published in February 1992, officials at the U.S. Export-Import Bank, which provides loan guarantees to foreign countries for purchases from U.S. companies, wanted to deny Iraq hundreds of millions of dollars worth of loan credits because, in their opinion, there wasn't a reasonable assurance of repayment. But who should step in and press the bank to relent? George Bush Sr., then Reagan's vice president. Bush Sr.'s direct involvement in securing financial assistance for Iraq carried over into his own presidency. Through export-import bank loans, billions of dollars in agricultural credits from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and permits from the U.S. Commerce Department to purchase so-called dual-use technology, meaning technologies that could have both military and civilian purposes, the Iraqi regime was able to build its war machine. Citing classified documents, the Los Angeles Times reports that as president and vice president, George Bush Sr. personally intervened on numerous occasions to support and placate Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. Chris Tensing of Middle East Report says that one of George Bush Sr.'s motives was access to Iraqi oil.
At the beginning of the first Bush administration, in the years before Iraq invaded Kuwait, Bush continued what had been Reagan's policy of trying to establish closer relations with Iraq. Diplomatic relations with Iraq were restored in 1984 in the middle of Iraq's very bloody war of aggression against Iran. And Bush was continuing those efforts in an attempt to get American oil companies preferential access to Iraq's oil fields in the event that Iraq were to relax its nationalization of its petroleum industry.
Covert support for Iran, says Rahul Mahajan, author of The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism, was part of a U.S. strategy to contain both countries in the conflict.
But it helped Iraq a lot more. It was very much tilted towards Iraq. It also provided Iraq with military technology, including biological warfare agents, and even, amazingly enough, the elements of nuclear ignition technology.
U.S. support for Saddam Hussein continued right up until the day the Iraqi military invaded Kuwait on August 2, 1990, the action that led to the Persian Gulf War. By then, with direct support from George Bush Sr. and other high-ranking U.S. officials, Iraq had amassed a deadly arsenal of chemical and biological weapons and the makings of a nuclear weapons program, while stiffing U.S. taxpayers $2 billion in defaulted loans. U.S. officials say that President Bush I has admitted he made a mistake in supporting Saddam Hussein. So, if Iraq poses a threat now, one that the United States participated in creating, should the U.S. try and eliminate that threat militarily? Rahul Mahajan.
To assume that people who are essentially serving the same motives, which is aggrandizement of American imperial power and increase of profits for American corporations, would somehow benignly undo the damage that they have done before is simply unreasonable. It is true that a lot of U.S. policy has helped prop up Saddam, not just in terms of getting him started, in which the CIA was involved, not just in terms of providing him with weapons and military intelligence through the 1980s, but in the 1990s as well. It's pretty clear that the sanctions regime levied on Iraq, mostly at the behest of the United States, has helped keep Saddam in power by essentially making internal opposition virtually impossible. The best way to remedy that is simply to lift all the external control and allow the Iraqi people to regenerate their own natural political process.
You are listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you would like a free copy of War Times, a publication that was launched to help broaden discussion and awareness of the so-called war on terrorism, please give us a call. It's toll-free, 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. And remember to ask for your free copy of War Times. In mid-September 2002, a U.S. delegation that was led by Congressman Nick Rahal and former Senator James Aberesk went to Iraq. The delegation also included James Jennings, president of Conscience International, and Norman Solomon, executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, who is also senior advisor to Making Contact. Participants in the delegation described it as a humanitarian mission. One of the goals was to convince Iraqi officials to permit United Nations weapons inspectors into the country. Independent journalist Reese Ehrlich, who accompanied the delegation, says that at the time there were no indications that Iraqi officials would make the offer they did, just days after the delegation arrived, to allow weapons inspectors full access to the country.
They argued, when we met with Tariq Aziz, the deputy prime minister, and the head of the national parliament there, the Majlis, and their argument was, look, we let the weapons inspectors in the past, and they sent in spies. And while it's acknowledged in the United States, kind of like in the bottom paragraphs of some stories, that's not an issue that's played up very much here. There is no question that the Americans who were part of the weapons inspection teams planted spy devices, which were later used in bombing attacks on Iraq. But Jim Aberesk and Nick Rahal, the politicians from the U.S., argued, well, look, even if that's true, for sure you are going to get invaded if you don't allow the inspectors in. The only chance for any kind of a political settlement and pressure from other countries on the Security Council is if you agree to do that.
Journalist Reese Ehrlich, who's working on a documentary for public radio titled Children of War, Fighting, Dying, and Surviving, also assessed the impact of U.S.-led economic sanctions against Iraq in place since 1991.
We visited the Al-Mansour Pediatric Hospital in Baghdad, and while there we talked with Dr. Saad Hassani, who is the chief resident in the pediatric wards, and he told us about the conditions facing the children with cancer and leukemia in Baghdad.
Here we can see a lot of rare malignant disorders in children, and even the age group is different. Here we have babies of 6 months age and even 3 or 4 months age. If there is a missing of one or two items, this will drop the prognosis dramatically. The United States supplied Iraq previously with these material, but from time to time it is missing for 1 month or 2 months, and then they supply it again. And that's the way the United States fight Iraqi people or children. That's the way they kill these children.
What is the prognosis for this baby?
It's very bad because there is a relapse, and when there is a relapse, the chance for survival will be less than 5%, even in the United States.
There's a big upsurge in childhood leukemia and cancer in the south, in Basra, where the U.S. used massive amounts of depleted uranium. For listeners who don't know, the U.S. coats artillery shells, tank shells, apparently some missiles, with depleted uranium because it's a very heavy metal and it penetrates armor buildings very effectively. So the U.S. military loves it. The problem is it also lets off radiation. And when it hits the target, it explodes, intense heat, it goes into the air, it may well get into the atmosphere in terms of the water, the land. And they've in Basra have seen an incredible increase in birth defects, in childhood cancers, and childhood leukemia that they had not seen before 1990. There's something very, very serious going on. They have no treatment for these kids, for the leukemia patients, and they basically send the kids home to die.
Independent journalist Rhys Ehrlich, his documentary Children of War, Fighting, Dying, and Surviving, will air on public radio stations in March 2003. Despite 12 years of economic and military sanctions against Iraq, some supporters of a U.S. invasion claim that Saddam Hussein is stronger than he was in 1991 at the beginning of the Gulf War. In September 2002, British Prime Minister Tony Blair released his government's assessment of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, a so-called dossier on Iraq. Blair writes that he, quote, believes that the assessed intelligence has established beyond a doubt that Saddam has continued to produce chemical and biological weapons, that he continues in his efforts to develop nuclear weapons, and that he has been able to extend the range of his ballistic missile program, end quote. Blair makes it clear that the British government is unable to reveal its sources or specific evidence to the public. But Niles Gardner, a security policy expert who's a visiting fellow at the Conservative Heritage Foundation, says that, in his opinion, the assessment by British intelligence is credible.
The British government dossier was based upon very, very careful evidence gathered by MI6, which is the British Foreign Intelligence Service. Of course, you have a number of agents operating on the ground within Iraq who are able to assess the latest situation. It's also based upon discussions with a number of defectors from the Iraqi regime, some of whom have worked upon Iraq's programs to develop chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. I've every reason to believe that this report is thoroughly reliable.
In response to the dossier on Iraq, Prime Minister Blair's own political party, the Labour Party, released a counter-dossier. In its conclusion, the Labour Party said that the British government's assessment of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction was, quote, based largely on hypothetical analysis of worst-case scenarios. The Labour Party went on to say that, quote, you can't launch a war on the basis of unconfirmed suspicions of both weapons and intentions. Susan Wright, a research scientist at the University of Michigan and the editor and co-author of the book Biological Warfare and Disarmament, New Problems, New Perspectives, says no one can be certain that Iraq possesses weapons of mass destruction because United Nations weapons inspectors haven't been in the country since 1998.
So it's very hard for anyone to be sure. In fact, I'm rather amazed at how sure our president seems to be about this. It's very clear that others who have looked at the Iraq situation are not nearly as convinced as he is that Iraq, for example, has nuclear weapons. I think the best and most detailed reports say the opposite. And very little is known about its holdings of chemical and biological weapons at this point.
In fact, the British daily newspaper, The Guardian, reported the day after Bush's October 7th speech that the president's case against Saddam Hussein relied on a slanted and sometimes entirely false reading of the available U.S. intelligence. The paper cited U.S. government officials and analysts. One former CIA official said, cooked-up information is working its way into high-level pronouncements. And a U.S. Department of Energy specialist told The Guardian that there's not much support for the nuclear theory around here, referring to Bush's claim that the Iraqi regime was nearing completion of nuclear weapons.
Facing clear evidence of peril, we cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun, that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
The mushroom cloud is most likely to come from the United States if it comes.
Jacqueline Cabasso is executive director of the Western States Legal Foundation, a public interest organization that monitors and analyzes U.S. nuclear weapons programs and policies.
The United States is shifting now to a preemptive strategy. This is laid out in the National Security Strategy of the United States document, which, to quote, says that, as a matter of common sense and defense, America will act against emerging threats before they are fully formed. And then if you want to correlate that with the Nuclear Posture Review, the classified document that was leaked to the New York Times in March, you get the fact that nuclear weapons might be used in case of surprising military developments, and that immediate contingencies involve well-recognized current dangers. Current examples of immediate contingencies include an Iraqi attack on Israel or its neighbors.
Meanwhile, many opponents of a U.S.-led war against Iraq have urged the return of United Nations weapons inspectors. Bush and others who support preemptive strikes against Iraq say that approach has been tried and it failed. But Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of Before and After, U.S. Foreign Policy and the September 11th Crisis, says despite interference from the Iraqi regime, UN inspection teams did locate and destroy a large percentage of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction and capabilities to produce more.
The inspectors at the time that they left Iraq said that they could confirm that 90 to 95% of Iraq's weapons capacity, weapons of mass destruction capacity, had been accounted for and destroyed or rendered harmless. There were a few long-range missiles, three or four, that they weren't able to account for. There were small amounts of chemical and biological weapons unaccounted for. But the overwhelming majority of the infrastructure for creating weapons of mass destruction was, in fact, identified, located, and destroyed.
UN inspectors left Iraq in 1998. It's often said in the mass media that Iraq kicked them out, but that's not the case. After the Clinton administration alerted the UN's chief inspector, Richard Butler, that the bombing campaign, known as Operation Desert Fox, was about to get underway, Butler ordered the UN inspection team to depart. President Bush has also spoken emphatically about links between the terrorist organization Al-Qaeda and the Iraqi regime, raising the specter that it may take far less than a robust weapons of mass destruction program to wreak havoc on the United States.
We know that Iraq and Al-Qaeda have had high-level contacts that go back a decade. Some Al-Qaeda leaders who fled Afghanistan went to Iraq. These include one very senior Al-Qaeda leader who received medical treatment in Baghdad this year and who has been associated with planning for chemical and biological attacks.
This entire link between Al-Qaeda and Saddam is entirely laughable.
Assad Abu-Khalil, author of Bin Laden, Islam, and America's New War on Terrorism, says it's highly unlikely Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein would work together.
There are more Al-Qaeda, based on what the U.S. government is saying, there are more Al-Qaeda in America than there are in Iraq. And I hope the United States is not planning to bomb the United States. This historically is going to prove to be the biggest, flattest lie of all, you know, to try to create a bogus link. Not because Saddam is above anything immoral or terroristic, but it's because Saddam and bin Laden are ideological foes. They cannot come together and agree on anything.
The Guardian newspaper in London reported on October 8th that there is skepticism among U.S. intelligence officials about Bush's claims of links between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. One source said the man Bush referred to in his October 7th speech as a senior Al-Qaeda leader who received medical treatment in Baghdad did not mention any cooperation with the Iraqi government during phone calls that were intercepted by intelligence officials. The Guardian also cites a former CIA agent who tracked the rise of Al-Qaeda. He said that he's unaware of any evidence of Saddam Hussein pursuing terrorism against the United States. Still, many believe, with the memory of the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon still fresh on their mind, it's more important to strike first rather than wait for definitive proof that Iraq poses a grave and growing danger.
If we strike first, what kind of message does that send to the tinderboxes of Pakistan and India, China and Taiwan, North and South Korea?
Congressman David Bonnier, Democrat from Michigan, speaking on the House floor October 8th.
By rushing into war, we alone will bear the burdens of seeing this conflict to its bloody end, most likely in the streets of Baghdad among innocent families and U.S. troops engaged in door-to-door combat. By rushing into war, we alone will be responsible for splintering the international coalition that has been built to fight the imminent threat posed by the terrorist Al-Qaeda. And by rushing into war, we alone will fuel more extremist passions against the United States, a whole new generation of terrorists bent on our demise.
U.S. officials who support the war promise a swift and victorious military campaign, a promise made many times before war, including before the protracted conflict in Vietnam. Independent journalist Reese Ehrlich says overthrowing the Iraqi regime could be more difficult than we're led to believe in the United States.
We were able to interview Tariq Aziz, the deputy prime minister of Iraq, and he told us that this war was going to be different than 1991 and that Iraqis were going to be prepared to fight door-to-door if necessary to repel a U.S. occupation.
There is a difference between this war and the war in 1991. If he wants to change the regime in Iraq, he has to come into Iraq. Into Iraq, into each and every city and occupy it one by one. And you could imagine what the result will be, because the Iraqi people are going to defend their own sovereignty. Everybody who is endangered by this invasion is going to fight.
Other people were much more sanguine, and they said basically, well, we're just going to stay at home because there's nothing we can do. The shelters are no good. There's no place in the countryside we can go to. And it was pretty clear they were not going to be taking up. They didn't support the U.S. invasion. That was clear. But neither did they support the Hussein government and were not about to go out into the streets fighting for them.
The net result, says Assad Abu-Khalil, could be more terrorism against the United States.
Al-Qaeda and everybody else who hates the United States is going to be excited with the climate of antipathy and anger against the United States that is going to follow from the first bomb that were dropped on Baghdad and Iraq that's going to affect the civilian population.
A war against Iraq could also take its toll on the federal budget, says Rania Masri.
This war, according to conservative estimates, will cost American taxpayers $100 billion. $100 billion is three times what the federal government spends on K-12 education. So if we look at it that way, that our government is willing to take a quarter of a million U.S. soldiers to kill at very least tens of thousands of Iraqis, to build instability, to increase anti-American sentiment, to remove a dictator, to replace him with another dictator, and to spend $100 billion of our taxpayer money all on the basis of speculation and rhetoric. And then do we support this war?
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact, a look at Iraq. Thanks for listening. If you would like more information about the subject of this week's program, or if you would like to get in touch with any of our guests, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number to get a free copy of War Times, a publication that was launched to help broaden discussion and awareness of the so-called war on terrorism. That's 800-529-5736. You can also check out our website at radioproject.org. That's radioproject.org. Making Contact is an independent production. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you have suggestions for future programs, we'd love to hear from you. Laura Levati is our acting executive director, Peggy Law, founding director, Amy Pomerleau, associate producer, Lisa Rudman, women's desk director, Rosalind Fay, administrative coordinator, Susanna Hines, executive assistant, Norman Solomon, senior advisor, David Barsamian, national producer. And I'm your host and managing producer, Philip Babbage. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Until next time,